and under-delivered. With only 25% of seats, they are the main opposition party, but are small enough to be easily brushed aside by the right wing. The new kingmakers are the mainstream conservative party, but Macron's record of legalizing Islamophobia, far-right economic policies, often passed via authoritarian decree, and his brutal repression of the Yellow Vests has caused many to say for years that Macron is actually a mainstream conservative, but with a new party logo. Despite a prolonged period of once-in-a-century social unrest, the French political landscape has barely been changed. If essentially the same people in power don't change how they govern, many say the next 5 years could be dangerously explosive. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Amid a decline in military operations since the UN ceasefire took effect in April, the number of victims of banned weapons in Yemen keeps rising. Remnants of Saudi cluster bombs are taking more lives as Riyadh refuses to allow badly needed equipment, including mine detectors, to enter the war-torn country. Yemen's Mine Action Center reported 120 cases since the start of the truce, 26 of them in the first third of June.
Since the beginning of this year, 326 people have fallen victim to leftover cluster bombs. 120 of them alone have been killed since the start of the truce. The bombings of the Saudi-led coalition continue to claim the lives of innocent citizens on a daily basis. Unfortunately, the Saudi-led coalition has been preventing the entry of necessary equipment for years, even though our work is for humanitarian purposes. Therefore, we believe that the coalition seeks to kill civilians even after the end of the war.
The Mine Action Center says the Saudi-led coalition has prevented the entry of mine detectors to Sana'a since 2018 for no good reason, and field teams are still working despite all the risks.
The biggest problem that the center faces is the lack of mine detectors and field equipment. We have been facing this problem since the outset, and unfortunately, the devices and personal protection equipment were not provided even throughout the years of war. In 2018, the United Nations informed us that our equipment had arrived in Djibouti. But much to our surprise, part of it was held by the Saudi-led coalition and some was handed over to other parties not affiliated with us, and we have not received anything until this moment.
During the seven-year war, the Saudi-led coalition has used 15 types of internationally prohibited cluster bombs in its attacks against residential areas across Yemen. However, officials say relevant international organizations refrain from cooperating for political reasons.
People here are dying due to the remnants of internationally banned weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition. Experts believe the number of victims will continue to rise unless the coalition allows the needed equipment to defuse the weapons that kill Yemeni women and the children to enter Yemen. Abdul Latif Lwashali, Sana'a.
A warm welcome for a new chapter in the Iran-Kazakhstan relations. On Sunday, Kazakh President Qasem Jomart Tokayev arrived in Tehran at the invitation of his Iranian counterpart Ebrahim Raisi. After an hour-long meeting, the two sides oversaw the signing of several cooperation documents on transport, energy and tourism, among other areas.
Despite the existing geopolitical situation and restrictions, Kazakhstan and Iran managed to increase their bilateral trade by 50% over the past 3 months. With today's MOUs, I'm certain that we will achieve a lot more in our interactions.
Iran was the first country that recognized Kazakhstan's independence following the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991. That was when Tehran and Nur Sultan began their diplomatic ties. President Raisi says the two nations have never been closer.
This visit by the Honorable Kazakh President is undoubtedly a milestone in Iran-Kazakhstan relations. Over the past 30 years, we have maintained fraternal ties with our neighbor, Kazakhstan, but the level of our relations need to be enhanced.
Iran and Kazakhstan are both members of the Economic Cooperation Organization, ECO. This provides a safe trading channel for the two countries, without worries over the impacts of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
We need to expand our cooperation through regional organizations such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the Eurasian Economic Union.
Since he took office less than a year ago, President Raisi has been trying to establish closer neighborly ties, as he believes this would obviate the need for Iran to wait for the fate of the ailing 2015 deal with the world powers to improve its economy.
Before the coronavirus pandemic, Iran and Kazakhstan's annual trade exceeded $1 billion, but the pandemic pushed this figure down to around $200 million. Today, the two presidents vowed to push the envelope of their country's commercial interaction and set a $3 billion mark for their annual trade. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Demonstrators gathered from around France to demand the release of Europe's oldest political prisoner. George Ibrahim Abdullah, who was known as the Arab Nelson Mandela, has been imprisoned for more than 38 years and has become a beloved hero celebrated around the world. In 1982, once again, Israel was invading Lebanon. Abdullah's resistance group claimed responsibility for the death of an Israeli and an American agent in Paris. Abdullah has been eligible for parole since 1999. He refuses to repent or to recant his support for Palestine, and while some say that's a reason he hasn't been released, most believe it's due to political pressure from Washington and Tel Aviv.
We're here to demand freedom for both George Abdullah and for Palestine. Pro-Palestinian activists in France are fed up with the state's repression of our message, their support for Israel, and the lack of justice for our hero, Abdullah.
Abdullah is described as a model prisoner and maintains a vast correspondence with groups supporting anti-imperialism, anti-Zionism, and leftist politics. Many believe Abdullah, a former school teacher and Maronite Christian, is exactly the type of unifying and heroic figure who could unite a fragmented and troubled Lebanese nation.
The reason of George Abdullah being arrested, not only because of his support to Palestine and his struggle, but because they are afraid of this icon, Arab and internationalist icon who influenced the left movement around the world.
No French media were at the demonstration for Abdullah. Despite the apparent Western media blackout, his supporters worldwide say they will never stop fighting for his liberation from French injustice. This week, the British government approved the extradition to the United States of another famous political prisoner of the West, Julian Assange, founder of WikiLeaks. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
On Saturday, demonstrations were held in more than 20 Italian cities as socioeconomic conditions in the country worsened by the day. 2 years of stringent restrictions to counter the COVID pandemic and the waves of sanctions against Russia that have followed Moscow's military operation in Ukraine are dragging Italy into its deepest recession since World War II. In Rome, thousands gathered in People's Square for a rally called by Italy's major trade union, CGIL. The unionists called on the government to improve the country's employment situation, put an end to socioeconomic inequalities, and adopt measures to counter growing inflation and the ongoing energy crisis.
It is not acceptable that we are not consulted by the government when they introduce important provisions. A growing number of people cannot make ends meet, and extraordinary measures are needed. We must have our say.
Also on Saturday, a string of left-leaning pro-sovereignty movements staged anti-government protests in 22 cities, including Rome, Genoa, Trieste and Cagliari. In the Italian capital, over 1,000 people protested against arms supplies to Ukraine and the adoption of sanctions against Russia, which they say are only damaging Italy and the Italians.
There is a major difference between what the Italians think about the Ukraine war and the way the economy should be run and what the government and the parliament do. Finally, on Tuesday, for the first time since the start of the war, Prime Minister Draghi will address the parliament. Draghi has so far done everything he wanted.
There has been talk of a possible government crisis after Mario Draghi addresses the Senate on June 21st. A growing number of lawmakers complained that no debate has so far been held on crucial issues, including how anti-Russia sanctions can affect Italy.
High inflation, rising costs of energy, high levels of unemployment. All Italy's socioeconomic indicators are headed downwards. In addition to that, the wealthy northern Italy has been hit by an unprecedented drought, which is severely threatening water supplies and the agri-food sector, as the country is struggling to cope with years of negligence and bad policies. A hot autumn of strikes and protests is widely expected. Max Civili, Rome.
Millions of businesses across the European Union are struggling to stay open due to unprecedented costs relating to energy and supplies. We spoke to one cafe owner in Brussels.
How is it possible to survive in business? Electricity, oil, gas, and buying in stock is crazy. Prices are crazy. If we do not get more support, we will go under.
Inflation is through the roof. Poverty is on the rise. EU finance ministers have been told there needs to be a more coordinated response.
We continue to support our economies, but not in a universal way as we did during the COVID crisis, in a more targeted way.
Most EU nations are also members of NATO. An EU army is being developed. Social inequality is a growing problem, but there is no end of money for lethal weapons.
An enormous amount of equipment, ammunition, weapons have already arrived in Ukraine. But of course there are bottlenecks, there are challenges, and there also are some requirements, for instance, for training, for spare parts to be delivered together with the specific weapons.
Even Pope Francis says the war in Ukraine was provoked or not prevented by the West. Last September, an EU agency outlined the incredible scale of corruption in Ukraine. Despite this, Kiev looks poised to join the 27-nation bloc.
Yes, Ukraine deserves European perspective. Yes, Ukraine should be welcomed as a candidate country.
Economists say sanctions against Russia are going to push up prices in the EU even more.
And some suggest Euroscepticism is going to rise like never before, resulting in the EU project crumbling by the year 2030. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
More than 50,000 Britons are refusing to work in the biggest strike in more than three decades. They're protesting their below inflation pay. London's Underground also remains shut. Train services will also be canceled. Strike leaders insist the campaign will run for as long as necessary. In Belgium, tens of thousands of people took part in the march in Brussels on Monday, demanding measures to offset record high inflation. Thousands also took to the streets in Ireland after inflation surged to its highest level since the 1980s, prompting cost of living protests across the country. Germany is also facing certain recession if already faltering Russian gas supplies completely stop, and Italy is saying it will consider offering financial backing to help companies refill gas storage to avoid a deeper crisis in winter. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who is joining me in this episode. Historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling from Bristol. Also with us will be Secretary General of the CIPI Foundation, Paola Raffone. He's joining us out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, Tony, first off, the big picture question. Now, what, in your opinion, is the number one factor responsible for this economic chaos in Europe? Of course, we'll be discussing the situation in some European countries later on in the show.
Well, look, you're hearing my voice. Most people in Britain would never hear my voice, even though I was trained on the BBC to report on these sorts of matters, and they won't see my face. Some would say that's a good thing. But look, it's because I am giving a point of view which is anti-finance capitalism. And it's not just me, it's the leaders of the RMT, Rail Maritime Transport Union, here in Britain that are doing the same. They're saying that finance capitalism is basically killing the entire economy because it's making it impossible for people to afford to live. And therefore, people are being driven out of the industry. So I'm just one of those voices silenced in the UK now because as people like Michael Hudson have pointed out, finance capitalism is killing the host. Its profit is the only thing that matters. And the real problem is that the living costs in Britain and elsewhere have become astronomical. But basically, here in Britain, these are many of the things which were privatised by Margaret Thatcher back in the 1980s, things like electricity, gas, water, housing, all the things, transport as well, by the way, all the things which we need just simply to get by day to day are now in private hands, and those privateers are basically raking off massive profits because they're not contributing anything anymore. They can't compete financially with the rest of the world. An economic failure, Britain and America now are, and much of Europe too, with the notable exception of the Germans. We can't manufacture things because living costs and all these other costs are so high. That's why they call it the cost of living crisis. But the crux of it is rent. How much it costs to house yourself is now roughly 100 times what it costs to, say, for example, to compare it to what it costs to actually build a home, to what it costs to rent and buy a home in Britain today, is 99% of that money is going to people who are making a profit off of your need to find somewhere to live. And the most shattering and shameful thing is that we're hearing it here on press TV, but we're not hearing it anywhere really in the mainstream press in the UK. The fact that effectively we've got a form of capitalism, finance capitalism, which is completely taking over from the old-fashioned capitalism, which was real free market capitalism, where people were paid sensible wages and that the people were making profits in the country. The capitalists weren't preying on people's need for water, fuel, food, energy, and transport, these kind of basic essentials. So that's what's at the bottom of it. But when it comes to the rail strike, we have something like 50,000 people out on strike. They are being very, very clear about they're sending a message to the rest of the public sector workers in Britain because this is one of the great scandals of the rail strike, the government actually owns three of the large rail franchises here in Britain. The government has flatly refused to even talk to and negotiate with the union. So it's hardly surprising that there's been a strike. It's almost as if the government want a strike. Maybe they want to try and sack all these people and employ robots to do their jobs, or cheap migrant workers who have never been trained to run a railway to do their jobs, because that's the kind of Britain we're living in today.
Okay. Now, Paolo, I want to ask you this question. Is it Russia or the wrong policies of the Western states that have wreaked havoc with this so-called cost of living and soaring energy prices in Europe and the U.S.?
Well, the simplified binary narrative says that this is so simple. Everybody understands that this is not the in the West, in the Western economy and finance has started grappling in 2006, 2008, and it has never recovered to the situation prior to that date. In order to have the system float, the governments have been printing quantitative easing, which is creating money out of nowhere, basically, which has allowed a sort of normalcy to appear, but in fact it has devalued the value of those currencies as well as put all the premises for inflation. The pandemic came as a help in the sense that it has been hiding the reality of the economy, which was already in distress. And because of the pandemic, even further quantitative easing has been pulled into the market. Then the pandemic ended. And in fact, a restart of the normal life and economy and consumption has pushed even further the inflationary points. And therefore, this has been the situation prior to the Russian military operation. The military operation has increased the situation for Europe, especially for Europe, because it has added the energy supply problem, which has pushed up even further the inflationary data. But we cannot say in a very simplified way that this is the fault of Putin.
Right. Okay, Tony, the European Union is under mounting pressure for spending billions of euros on arming Ukraine. And that's at a time when the bloc's citizens are struggling to make ends meet, as you know. And that was echoed on the streets of Brussels yesterday by ralliers. Still, the EU is planning to slap more sanctions on Moscow or the war in Ukraine. Is this the right decision?
Well, this is a decision which is being made by an elite cabinet of people who seem to support. So they are in the process of extraditing Julian Assange to the United States, who's one of the greatest investigative journalists of the 21st century and has not committed any crime in Britain whatsoever. That, I'm afraid, is what we have for leaders now in Britain. And the other thing is this matter of inflation, particularly in energy prices. We've now got general inflation, because that's what happens when you start putting up energy prices. Everything starts to cost more. Is actually the cause of that is these new green taxes that the British have brought in. In the UK, we are supposed to have had a Brexit. Now, this is something which has come in right across the European Union. Many of them happening, increases in fuel prices covered up by the oil companies who increased their price before Christmas. This is supposed to be a European thing, but the British have also sneakily, with the collusion of the oil cartels, brought these price increases in fuel in too. And this has a massive knock-on effect. Now, they've made an attempt to blame this on the Russians. Of course, that's not gone down very well in Britain, and I don't think that that's really succeeded to get through. What's happening, of course, is what we're having is the World Economic Forum, Prince Charles and his green tax friends, Klaus Schwab and the rest of them, are doing a great reset. They're doing it very in slow motion, and what they're doing is they're driving many ordinary people in Britain down into debt. When we're looking at particularly at what's happening with the train strikes, which are really massively affecting the life of Britons over the next week and possibly further into the summer, they've said it possibly even on until Christmas, is the disruption that it's causing to people is enormous. And there seems to be a certain delight within the Green lobby that the energy prices are being forced up and up, and people have to pay more for their cars. But of course, what this means to the world markets is actually more coal will be being used around the world because oil prices are so high. Also, automation is one of the big reasons for this strike, and this is of course replacing human beings. Employ human beings with decent contracts that the railway staff presently have with automation. So that is to say, within a year or so, the British Railways, the organisers, who, by the way, about a collection of something like 20 or 25 of them get paid anything between £125,000 a year and £800,000 a year for the chief executive. So they're creaming off the money that's coming in from these rail passengers for themselves. But what they're doing is they're using that to then sack the staff, because this is what the shareholders like. They like more profit. What they're doing is old-fashioned language is they're sweating the assets. So they're using the assets, they're asset stripping, and they're using the assets to just get rid of all of the costs. And the costs include human beings who look after people's safety on the trains. They want to have even some of these trains with no person on them. So what happens if there's a crash? What happens if there's violence? There's some hooligans, a disturbance on the train. There'll be nobody there to do anything about it. But they don't really care, I'm afraid. The shareholders don't care about that. Because they've dehumanized these railways using automation. So although it's not just about the railways, I know you want to talk about the other things. I think it's a great example of how in Britain, one of the basic bits of infrastructure is being sweated and sweated by the finance capitalists. And finally, they're feeling the pinch. And I hope that there's a settlement in this dispute and that the people can retain their dignity and their decent pay. Some people, by the way, have been sacked from the railways. I was speaking to someone on a train the other day, and they've been told, you're going to have to reapply for your own job, and it's going to be 20% less pay. This is the way they're treating their really important assets, who talk to the customers every day. These executives never see a customer, never speak to a rail passenger at all. They just sit in raking in the profits and dishing them out to the shareholders.
Okay, Paolo, speaking of the UK, the government is under a lot of pressure, for the economic policies, and this is while the country is facing high inflation. So what is it that the Downing Street and the Johnson administration has failed to do to address the issue?
I didn't get the final part of your question, sorry.
No, I'm talking about the economic situation and the cost of living crisis, energy prices, and all the economic issues that Britain is facing.
Yeah, but Britain is the best example of what the other interlocutor is saying. In Britain, since the early 80s, have been applied the neoliberal recipes of finance capitalism, and we are seeing what is happening. It's not the first time. The situation is really out of control. Global Britain is a beautiful story that has been circled by Johnson, but in fact, instead of global Britain, there will be a smaller Britain and much poorer than before. That's the reality. But this is something which should be coming as a warning to the rest of the Western countries, because after Britain, there is the US. In the US, the situation is not going any better. Western Europe is strangled with nonsense sanctions and wrong policies which are being implemented, especially in the energy sector. And therefore, the entire Western primacy in economy is under question at this moment.
Now, Tony, let's take a glance at Germany. BDI Industry Association has slashed its economic growth forecast for 2020 to 1.5%. It revised it down from 3% expected before the Ukraine war. And it's saying that a halt in the Russian gas deliveries would make recession inevitable. So your assessment of how Germany is impacted?
Well, Germany is likely to be more impacted in many ways in Britain, because it's still a very important industrial hub. They still have in Germany something called industrial capitalism, which is the need to actually make things and sell them in order to make money, and they are very good at it in Germany. The Brits have basically sold out years ago. And the interesting thing for me is the connection between these policies and NATO and the military policies towards Russia, Iran, and China. Because as Michael Hudson points out in his new book, which is about the Future of Civilization, finance capitalism, industrial capitalism, or socialism. He's pointed out that we have to keep, and in fact that the war that's going on even now in Russia is really an ideological war in a way, between countries that believe that you've just got to be able to sell everything off to the highest bidder, including your national infrastructure, and other countries like Russia, etc., that think that the government has to play an independent role in making sure that the infrastructure of the country is supplied at cost, so that people can start businesses and actually compete. What happens is in finance capitalism is everything like here in Britain now. The cost of living becomes so expensive that there is barriers to entry to the market, and there's no real entrepreneurialism going on anymore. All the people who got trained in industries are now seem to be working in these other industries like the railways, etc., which are now being sweated. The assets are being sweated there. But we, as a result of all of this, you know, we've got a basic clash of civilizations going on, as Hudson points out, between the West, which is really talking of, where we're talking about finance capitalism, money rules, and the Russians and other powers in the world, which are realistically saying that in order to have sovereignty, the government must assert itself and take control of these various key industries that we've got around the world. And also, of course, we've been seeing protests here in Britain too, hardly covered in the mainstream press because they're embarrassed to see thousands of people out on the streets on Sunday supporting the rail workers and also lobbying the government, protesters, a peaceful protest, lobbying the government, saying we need more government help and intervention to make sure that people can actually afford to feed their children, to pay the rent, to even to maybe have a little bit left to go down the swimming pool and enjoy a day out with the children. That's the sort of thing I'm afraid Britons are now finding it very difficult to afford these things.
Okay, now, Paula, let's take a look at Italy now, you know, alongside Italy, alongside others, such as Germany, Denmark, Austria, and the Netherlands, has activated the first early warning stage of its three-stage plan to cope with a gas supply crisis. So let's take a look at the situation in Italy and how badly that country is affected.
Well, the choices that the European Union made, especially in the gas sector, in terms of policy, were evidently wrong when they decided to adhere to the concept of spot prices for the gas. This is now turning as a boomerang on the economies of Europe because prices are going up. We have to import this gas from somewhere else than Russia at prices that will be skyrocketing. All of this will increase the malfunctioning of the economy and the social unrest. This is clear. Families already in many countries find difficult to reach the end of the month to pay the bills and the rents. Prices are so high, evidently. I mean, it's not just a matter of statistics. It's enough to go to the market and buy your daily food, and you will see how prices have doubled. And we are here talking about little measures of the central bank to contrast an inflation which is far beyond the official rate, evidently.
Okay. Now, Tony, the sky-high European price has attracted more LNG cargoes, but Europe lacks the infrastructure to meet all its needs from LNG, and that's why the global LNG market is already stretched. Disruptions to a major U.S. producer of also liquefied natural gas that provided shipments to Europe added to this challenge. So what's in the offing?
Well, that's a good question. Look, buying, saying we're going to take Russian energy, the Brits have really shot themselves in the foot massively. I mean, this is a stupid thing to do, unless, of course, you want to create a crisis in your domestic economy and amongst your domestic people. I think this is just how crazy some of our leaders are in this part of the world, is they realize that they can't beat the Russians. The Russians are actually too tough, and their soldiers are, and their, you know, nuclear weapons are very, very strong too. So they've turned their ire on their own people. That's the only explanation I can see for this masochistic idea of completely cutting off gas and oil, which the Europeans and the British seem to want to do, and the Americans. And now, of course, this benefits the Americans. So it means the Americans are going to be able to sell more of their energy to Europe. And that, I think, is the real agenda, that this is a way of just knuckling down the Europeans to be obedient to American wishes. But we've got a massive structural problem, and that is that the governments we elect have really got very little or no power anymore. The people who are really running the show are the oil cartels, the banks, You know, the people like the Bilderberg conferences, which I've been studying for many years, these are groups of elites, including the media. And what shocks me as a former, shall we say, civil servant journalist here in Britain, is to see that the editors of the media here in the West go to these secret conferences and swear secrecy. They don't write about them. They won't tell anybody what goes on in there, because largely because their assets of their businesses and many of their bonuses come from the fact that many of these top executives around the Western world have got their money squirreled away in these tax havens. They're not paying any tax, whilst what's happening is the middle classes and the poorest people in Europe and around the West are now paying the tax that they should be paying. So that's, I'm afraid, the structural problem that's at the heart of this. And I think it's fairly clear to say that this is the sort of thing that the Russians are simply not prepared to put up with in Eastern Europe, nor are people in Donbass and the Donetsk. By the way, 15,000 of which have been killed by the Ukrainian army over the last, with the collusion of the West and people like Victoria Nuland, over the last 8 years since the 2014 coup there. People are not prepared to accept this. Also in Ukraine, by the way, when the coup happened in 2014, what you saw was a cutting of the money going to the regions in Ukraine. All of it was then concentrated in the center, and it was starving the regions of the cash that they were paying tax and that they need to carry on. So it's a structural problem, the finance capitalists taking over governments right across the West, and the Russians, etc., the Iranians, the Chinese are not going to have that.
Okay. Paolo, we have 1 minute left. Tell us if you know of any exits out of this situation.
Well, in one thing, this is quite a challenge, but the best way is to start recognizing that the Western supremacy is over. That's the reality. It's an important part of the world economy and power, but it's no more the only one and cannot be in the position of dictating to the rest of the world what to do. So if this would happen, it means that our leaders would be capable of sitting down with the rest of the world and try to redefine an order which is beneficial to all.
Okay. On that note, we'll come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling in Bristol and Secretary General of the CIPF Foundation, Paolo Raffone in Brussels. And thank you for watching this edition of The Spotlight. I've been your host, Fehruz Najaf, and I'll see you next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has responded to the biggest rail strikes in a generation with plans to break the industrial action by allowing firms to bring in agency staff, a move unions have decried as unworkable, unsafe, and potentially breaking international law. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, Boris Johnson plans to break rail strikes by allowing use of agency workers. And Prime Minister Boris Johnson has responded to the biggest rail strikes in a generation with plans to break the industrial action by allowing firms to bring in agency staff, a move that unions have decried as unworkable, unsafe and potentially breaking international law. As 40,000 workers prepared for Tuesday's strike, the most wide-reaching on the railway's network in the past 30 years, Number 10 Downing Street brought forward changes to enable employers to replace employees with temporary staff. The highly controversial measure would make disputes long and bitter, unions warned on Monday, 20th of June. With the Trade Union Congress TUC accusing Boris Johnson of taking a step that even Margaret Thatcher did not go near. Instead, it would inflame divisions between employers and trade unions when the government should be trying to bring about a deal, they said. However, the Prime Minister accused the union of too high demands on pay and said it was necessary for public sector employers to show pay discipline and restraint to prevent even higher inflation, saying it was necessary salary deals remain sensible. Earlier this year, Downing Street had disagreed with the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey when he said workers should not expect pay rises matching inflation, saying Boris Johnson wanted a high-wage economy. But on Monday, 20th of June, the Prime Minister stressed the need for public sector pay to be kept down, with Number 10 Downing Street saying the government had a responsibility to tackle inflation and stop it becoming entrenched. The rail strikes are to cause the cancellation of about 80% of train services on Tuesday, 21st of June, with further action scheduled for Thursday and Saturday after talks between rail operators and the RMT union broke down. London Underground workers will also walk out for 24 hours starting on Tuesday, 21st of June. Mick Lynch, the RMT's general secretary, raised the prospect of further strikes throughout the summer as the two sides remained far apart and ministers refused to join the negotiating table. Mick Lynch said their offers were unacceptable. What we've come to understand is the dead hand of this Tory government is all over this dispute, and the fingerprints of Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary, and the DNA of Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, are all over the problems in the railways, and indeed in this society. He said the source of the dispute was the government's decision to slash £4 billion of funding from National Rail and TfL, forcing companies to implement transport austerity, and they have prevented a settlement to this dispute. On BBC's Newsnight programme on Monday night, 20th of June, Mick Lynch said Network Rail had escalated the dispute at the talks that day by telling him there would be redundancies from 1st of July. It came during a heated debate with Digital Minister Chris Philp, in which he frequently accused the Conservative MP of being a liar. Union leaders and a leading recruitment body warned on Monday that the government's plans to repeal the ban on strike-breaking would only make things worse. No official announcement has been made, but Kwasi Kwarteng, the business secretary, tweeted, "Repealing these 1970s-era restrictions will give businesses the freedom to access skilled, temporary staff at short notice. Legislation is on its way." White House sources said the drive for the new anti-strike laws was, however, coming from No. 10 Downing Street and the Cabinet Office for political reasons, rather than the Business Department. Paul Nowak, the Deputy General Secretary of the TUC, said, "Laws against bringing in agency workers have been in place since this was outlawed in 1973. Even Margaret Thatcher didn't go near it, but Boris Johnson has pulled out the playbook." He said the Prime Minister appeared to be trying to unite his own side around a conflict with trade unions as part of Operation Save Big Dog, the nickname for the effort to shore up his flagging premiership. Paul Nowak said there were safety concerns with bringing in agency workers who might have little experience in what they are being asked to do and would be put in an uncomfortable position of having to cross a picket line. "It prolongs disputes. It makes them very bitter. The use of agency workers themselves becomes another point of conflict between employers and the unions," he said. "We have real concerns agency workers will be pitted against directly employed staff." Paul Nowak, the Deputy General Secretary of the TUC, also questioned the legality of repealing the ban. "Once again, this government is showing its disregard for international law, which these proposals almost certainly breach," Paul Nowak added, citing the right to take strike action under the principles of the United Nations International Labour Organization, ILO. A joint statement from the TUC and the Recruitment and Employment Federation, REC, said the plan was counterproductive, impractical, and would put workers at risk. Neil Carberry, the Recruitment and Employment Federation's chief executive, said, "The government proposal will not work. Agency staff have a choice of roles and are highly unlikely to choose to cross picket lines. The plans would affect not just the railways but many other sectors where unions are considering strike ballots, including NHS staff, teachers, care workers, civil servants and refuse collectors. Unions representing the National Health Service staff also criticised the government's plan to encourage the use of agency workers in hospitals and other healthcare settings as unworkable and a threat to patient safety. Joanne Galbraith-Martin, the Royal College of Nursing's Director of Employment Relations and Legal Services, said, "This change would be undemocratic and unsafe. Any industrial action by our members is very carefully planned to keep patients safe. Bringing in less qualified or agency workers could put patients at risk." The managers in Partnership Union, which represents National Health Service managers, said the government was barking up the wrong tree by proposing the temporary replacement of striking NHS staff. Health unions normally guarantee life and limb cover, so they don't call all their members to strike, and therefore the government risks being alarmist, said John Restall, its chief executive. "There will be a raft of healthcare regulatory constraints on clinical staffing and service delivery. The government would be pretty reckless if it tried to ditch those for a period of industrial action," John Restall said. We'll be right back.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.